Researchers agree that to escape the worst impacts of climate change, we'll have to drastically reduce carbon emissions. How best to do that is up for debate.
Keeping those nuclear power plants operating as they are now is a very good low pollution strategy.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, how Pennsylvania is planning for a lower carbon future. Plus, to do the right thing, adults often look to children.
It's hard to deny a little six-year-old that's looking at you strangely if you put your plastic bottle in the garbage instead of putting it in the recycling bin.
And for some farmers, growing hemp is the future.
I really wasn't sure. I thought I knew what hemp was, but I asked my friends, and it's related to marijuana. Is this what marijuana comes from? I'm not really sure.
We'll lay your questions to rest. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Smoking often gets the blame for high cancer rates. But at a health conference in Pittsburgh on Tuesday, cancer experts said they're increasingly looking at environmental pollution. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
Researchers told the gathering of health and environment experts at Phipps Conservatory that Pennsylvanians have higher rates of cancer than the national average, and it's even higher in southwestern PA. The lung cancer rate in Allegheny County is about 30% higher than the national average. David Kriebel of the University of Massachusetts at Lowell studied cancer in 600 counties around the country, including Allegheny. He says that even if you take smoking out of the equation, the region would still have significant cancer rates.
There is a common narrative that says because smoking is such an important cause of cancer, that that's the number one priority. We somehow never get around to number two.
Kriebel says what's missing is a focus on pollution, diet, and personal care products. Other experts at the conference said lung and bladder cancer, both found to have high rates in Allegheny County, have been related to diesel exhaust and coke oven emissions. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Reports say the Trump administration will not regulate a group of toxic chemicals found in public water supplies. The chemicals are linked to cancer and other harmful health impacts. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports high levels of these chemicals have been found near military bases.
PFAS chemicals have been used in firefighting foam, nonstick cookware, and stain-resistant materials. Known as the forever chemicals, they don't break down in the environment and are not regulated by the federal government. The EPA is expected to release a plan to manage the chemicals soon. But the website Politico reports the agency plans not to regulate two of the chemicals under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Delaware Senator Tom Carper is chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee and says he's disappointed by the report.
It's not a question of whether it's harmful. The question is, are they going to develop a standard, a clean drinking water standard?
With a lack of federal oversight, New Jersey and some other states have started setting their own regulations. Pennsylvania created an action team, but has not yet set drinking water standards. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Governor Tom Wolf kicked off the new year with an ambitious climate change goal for Pennsylvania. He wants to reduce the state's greenhouse gas emissions 26% by 2025 and 80% by 2050. If that's achievable, State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk reports it will take a host of strategies.
When a power line needs repair, utility workers step into a bucket that extends high above their truck. Sarah Alexak with Duquesne Light in Pittsburgh shows me one of those vehicles.
This is all you're going to hear, just the sound of the fan and the batteries.
No idling that you get from one of the company's diesel trucks. And no tailpipe emissions. In addition to greening its own fleet, Alexak says Duquesne Light is working with parking authorities and local businesses to help install chargers for the public.
Your car is going to sit 8+ hours a day at a work site. It's a great place to charge up.
Better planning and incentives to increase electric vehicle use would result in significant greenhouse gas reductions for Pennsylvania. That's one suggestion for cutting emissions included in the state's most recent blueprint for addressing climate change. Pennsylvania is the nation's fourth largest emitter of carbon dioxide. Wolf based his new climate goals off 2005 emission levels, as coal-fired power plants shut down amid competition from cleaner natural gas and renewables. Pennsylvania is halfway to his 2025 target. Jay Apt with Carnegie Mellon University says that goal is feasible. As for the longer-term target,
the idea of having a goal of 80% reduction by 2050 will inform choices that we make now, because energy investments are very long-lived.
A gas power plant, for example, will operate for decades.
That's a big shadow that an investment today casts. And so having a goal now that articulates out 30 years into the future is quite reasonable.
Many in the environmental community wanted to see the governor do that. Mark Schiebest is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
It's absolutely the goal we need, but the market by itself is not going to get us there. We really need to do it through policy.
Like enacting a cap-and-trade program that sets a limit on emissions, or boosting a law to require even more renewables in Pennsylvania's power mix. But those ideas will be tough to get through a Republican-led legislature. Lawmakers this year are expected to debate whether to rescue the state's nuclear industry. Like coal, it's struggling to compete with gas and renewables. Nuclear reactors provide Pennsylvania's largest source of carbon-free power, but several are slated to close prematurely. Here's Apt again.
Keeping those nuclear power plants operating as they are now is a very good low-pollution strategy.
In announcing his climate goals, Wolf did not say if he would support such a plan. He did indicate he wants to see more natural gas development. The concern for Schiebest with the Natural Resources Defense Council is that gas will replace nuclear, and gas produces emissions.
The emission reductions that we've seen in the past few years, I think, are not durable. I mean, they're vulnerable to going back up again unless we figure out energy policy that will really drive development of renewables.
That blueprint the state has for reducing emissions? It includes renewables, nuclear, electric vehicles, energy efficiency, and more. Robert Graff of the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission is on the state's Climate Change Advisory Committee.
You're not going to reach the goal with just these strategies.
They only get Pennsylvania halfway to its 2050 target.
You have to walk a narrow path between what's effective and what's economically feasible, and also what will have less disruption to the way people like to live.
Maybe technological advances, federal action, or a shift in people's willingness to change their lifestyles will get us the rest of the way there. But all of that, he says, is really hard to predict. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
According to enthusiasts, hemp is a miracle crop that will help boost Pennsylvania's agricultural economy.
It sounds ridiculous. You know, it's like we say it can make 25,000 different products, and it sounds like such a gross exaggeration, but it's really not.
From oil you can buy in health food stores to tasty seeds, the hemp revolution is here. That's later on the Allegheny Front. Dire climate change predictions and the impacts of global warming that we're already experiencing can be tough for adults to get a handle on. So how do we talk to kids about it? Mary Beth Manarino is a psychologist and professor emerita at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. She's often asked about how to talk to kids about the existential threats of climate change, from her students or people who know that she's passionate about the topic. Manarino says climate change isn't on every parent's radar or priority list, but there are strategies that can help parents navigate conversations about a topic that scares many of them about their children's future. At what age is it appropriate to broach the subject of climate change with kids, or should you wait until they ask you about it?
I think one of my cardinal pieces of advice when I talk about these issues of climate change or other big things is to know your child. Some children will be curious, they will have heard things, and they'll ask questions. Other children may not ask questions, but it doesn't mean that they're not thinking about it. So keep in mind your child's personality. If your child is a particularly anxious-prone child, you'll want to keep that in mind when you talk with them. The libraries do carry some children's books for very young children about climate change, but as a parent, you should probably review those and make sure that they're appropriate for your particular child.
So toddlers up to, you know, elementary, middle school kids. I'm assuming that most high school kids know something about it.
Most high school kids, and actually many grade school kids. It's taught in some schools in the science programs. With toddlers and preschoolers, I would put most of the emphasis on thinking about our natural world in general and how our children and we are part of that, and seeing that as something to protect and be grateful for and experience at the very young levels. That's a more productive way to do it. And then if climate change or other environmental questions come up, then you talk about how people are working to make sure that we're taking care of things. It's kind of like what Mr. Rogers says, that you look for the helpers, and you, when you talk with children, you make sure that you can identify the positive things that people are doing to help things be better.
What should you say about climate change? Should you talk about the science of it, or, you know, how deep into it should you get?
Well, again, that depends on the child. Some children will be very curious about that. And depending upon your own level of knowledge and expertise, I think it's fine to factually answer things and to help them find resources to get more information or to do it together. With other kids, the underlying question is often, will I be okay? Are bad things going to happen? Who's going to take care of me? And with those kinds of kids, I think I would just frame it as, you know, the world often faces big, hard problems, and we all work together to try to solve them and make things better, and we're doing that with this.
Yeah, because we don't actually know how this is all going to turn out, I mean, as adults. So how do we handle that kind of uncertainty when we're talking to kids about climate change and, as you said, about their own future?
Yeah, so this is where I think parents really need to do some soul searching and self-care and think about this very carefully for themselves before they get into it with their children. We all deal with ambiguity and uncertainty in many aspects of our life, and this is one of the biggest and scariest ones if you're aware of it.
So is there a danger of projecting our fears onto kids?
It depends on the kid. I would caution against projecting your own fears on the child. I think you need to manage your strong emotions and think very carefully about how to talk about your own response to this situation. In talking with kids, I think it's okay to say, this is scary to me too. But I would put the focus on what they're feeling and on the places where action is being taken. And I also think, be aware that you're probably, even if you're not involved in activist work or any kind of protest about climate change, many families are already taking steps in the home that reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, which is a big part of climate change. If you're reducing the use of plastics, if you take your own grocery bags to the store, for example, that's something you're already doing.
So you can model that for your kids.
Right. And also if you're a family that has a garden or has pets or has plants in the house, you're already communicating your reverence and your respect for nature and how we take care of it.
What if your kid doesn't want to hear about climate change? Like, like it's a really important value to you.
I would respect that. Your kids take away so much more from what they observe you doing than they do from the words you say. So if a child is not ready to hear about something, I would respect that and tell them the door is always open and you're willing to talk. But I'd really respect that because a lot of kids take stuff in and process it before they're able to talk about it. I saw that in my own children following Columbine and 9/11, where one of them had question after question after question and really wanted to talk about it. And the other one just kind of sat with it. And I would be observant of your child if they do that, because sometimes that masks a lot of distress. Other times it's just their style that they need to sit with it for a while and they're taking it in and trying to process it themselves.
What should you absolutely not do or say?
That's very hard in these days. I would try my best not to make it an us-them kind of framework, good guys, bad guys. I would really try to find examples of how people are trying to cross over those bridges between different perspectives. I would not go doomsday. I think that adds to anxiety, which can go in all kinds of different directions that aren't healthy for kids. One of the other things that I think about a lot is the pervasiveness of media that's coming into the home. And this is particularly critical for older children and adolescents who have their own phones and access to the computer. But I would really kind of monitor what's coming into your family and into your child's eyes and ears about climate change and other distressing things, particularly if there's a natural disaster related to climate change like Hurricane Katrina or any of the other things that have happened. Your instinct may be to dive into that yourself and just try to absorb as much of the information as you can. But remember that your children may not be able to manage that. For them, it might be like trying to take a drink from a fire hose, and it just overwhelms them and knocks them down and scares them because they don't have the context for it that you do. I would not communicate helplessness, like it doesn't matter what we do or we're all going to hell in a handbasket. You know, I just wouldn't go that way. I think the way that you manage this is going to give your children tools that can be applied to many different difficult situations that come up.
Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Mary Beth Manarino is a psychologist and professor emerita at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. We've talked with her in the past about how to talk civilly about climate change with other adults, too. There are links at AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Well, some kids are ready and willing to talk about and work on solutions to climate change. And that's good news, because research shows that teaching children about the environment can influence their parents to live a more sustainable life. In other words, kids have power. That was the message of a workshop for educators in Western Pennsylvania recently. Andy Cubis has the story.
One other thing we talked about was getting students involved in doing monitoring of like air emissions, because people
teach teachers to empower students. That's the goal of this workshop, because it turns out kids are great environmental influencers.
It's hard to deny a little six-year-old that's looking at you strangely if you put your plastic bottle in the garbage instead of putting it in the recycling bin.
This is Kate Silvis, head of the education program at La Roche College, the host of today's workshop. About 30 educators from across Western Pennsylvania are here to learn how to get more kids engaged with environmental issues. Sally Rushford is the principal at Beechwood Elementary in Pittsburgh.
It's exactly what I want to happen in my school, creating this sense of efficacy and agency that's teaching a way of being that is going to make changes in the world.
But how do you motivate kids to want to change the world without overwhelming them with the enormity of environmental problems? Enter Lynn Cherry. She's the best-selling author of a bunch of really popular children's books that focus on the environment. One called The Great Kapok Tree sold over 1 million copies. But Cherry says that when she talked to kids about her books, she noticed something that concerned her.
I would see these kids get very upset when I would tell them about the rainforest being destroyed or rivers being polluted. And I realized that this was not motivating them. These stories were really, I thought, even maybe damaging them.
There's a name for this, motivated avoidance. It means when people are confronted with a problem that seems too big, they push it away. It happens to adults, and turns out it happens to children too.
However, if I told them stories of kids saving a wetland next to their school, or kids getting a ban on plastic bags, or saving a forest, they would get so excited and they would want to do something themselves.
Cherry decided to switch gears from books to short films. She created a series called Young Voices for the Planet as a way to champion the stories of kids who are taking action on climate change, like 10-year-old Jason Mellers, who is the focus of Cherry's newest film. She fought carbon pollution by talking about how the coal-fired power plant in her town was affecting her asthma. She and others lobbied to close it, and it worked.
And it was just really satisfying to know that all of our hard work paid off and that it wouldn't be hurting anybody anymore.
Even though I didn't have money, I had words, and words have power.
Cherry says these films have been incredibly effective. Students who've seen them have initiated plastic bag bans, planted millions of trees, and influenced legislation.
All these films are about young people who are leading the way, fighting climate change while they're addressing a lot of other environmental issues.
Anyway, where are we on our action plan?
Back at the workshop, Cherry encourages teachers to use her films in their classrooms so that their students will also be inspired to take action in their communities.
These kids realize that they're going to bear the brunt of climate disruption. And rather than wait until they can vote, they are, as they say, taking the reins now. And that's really what it's all about.
Because, Cherry says, the planet is not a place that kids will inherit at some point in the distant future. They live here now. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Kubis.
There are three more workshops for educators planned in Western Pennsylvania. The next one is February 23rd in Pittsburgh. More information about that and clips from some of the Voices for Change films are at AlleghenyFront.org. Young Voices for the Planet workshops are sponsored by the Heinz Endowments, which also supports the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University, celebrating over 25 years of preparing environmental professionals at both the undergraduate and graduate levels. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Featured programs include the Environmental Science and Management Master's Degree and Professional Certificate programs. Applications for the summer and fall semesters are now being accepted. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
Industrial hemp used to be grown across Pennsylvania and used for things like clothing, rope, and animal feed. Its popularity started to decline with the rise of cotton about 150 years ago. But the industry really suffered a setback when Congress outlawed it in the 1930s because of its similarities to marijuana. A new federal farm bill passed late last year removed hemp from the list of controlled substances. WITF's Rachel McDevitt reports that means the crop could once again become a familiar sight in the Commonwealth.
Through the 1800s, it was common to see hemp growing in fields like this one in Lancaster County. The area was known for the crop. At one point, more than 100 water-powered mills for processing hemp existed in Lancaster County alone.
But these dead sticks are what's left of our unharvested portions of our plants.
Alyssa Collins, a plant pathologist with Penn State Extension, demonstrates one of hemp's uses.
But you can kind of see how stringy this crop is and why it would be good for fiber, because you yank on this and you can't rip that. So that's why it's good for fiber. It's also why it's bad for equipment.
Penn State Extension was one of a few dozen entities permitted by the state to experiment with industrial hemp over the past 2 years. During the summer, just a few small patches were grown in the county for research purposes under a state pilot program. Researchers at Penn State specifically looked at ways to produce the most seeds from the plant. They also discovered some challenges to confront in the next round of study, such as hemp becoming tangled around traditional harvesting equipment. Potential hemp farmers can look to Canada, where the crop is already legal for some best practices. But Collins says Pennsylvania has a slightly longer growing season and different soils and diseases to factor in.
And so we need to make sure that we get varieties that work in our climate and with our seasons and our farming systems.
Collins says the crop might work to supplement a farmer's income if they can grow it without too much disruption. That could be especially helpful to dairy farmers who faced price drops, canceled contracts, and the fallout of international trade disputes last year. At the Pennsylvania Farm Show, passersby stopped, stared, and questioned their friends about a towering hemp plant set on a display table. Teens took pictures on their phones. Some people reached out to touch it. Pam Runzer, visiting from northwestern Pennsylvania, was a bit confused.
I really wasn't sure. I thought I knew what hemp was, but I asked my friends, and it's related to marijuana. Is this what marijuana comes from? I'm not really sure.
To be clear, hemp and marijuana are both forms of cannabis, but they are not the same. Les Stark with the Pennsylvania Hemp Industry Council has been explaining this difference to farm show attendees for over a decade. In the beginning, he says he got a lot of questions like Runzer's, but now he sees more farmers asking where they can buy seed. Stark, who's written a book about the history of hemp in Pennsylvania, says what's old is new again.
Pennsylvania was famous for hemp, especially Lancaster County. We were known for it, and yet now it's just this exciting new opportunity.
Before farmers can take advantage of that opportunity, they're going to need a supply chain, which for now doesn't exist. Erica McBride Stark, also with the council, says farmers will need the security of knowing there is a buyer for their hemp before they put seeds in the ground, and potential processors will want to know they'll have enough product to work with and sell. She says a recent change by the state agriculture department to lift a cap on the amount of hemp individuals can grow will help move the industry forward.
Because in order to attract the investment money we need to build the infrastructure, we needed unlimited acreage. And now we have it, and now there's a lot of big plans going on, and we should have a full-scale commercial processing facility in Pennsylvania, hopefully by the end of this year.
McBride Stark admits she's optimistic, but she believes the hemp industry in Pennsylvania could grow to be worth $1 billion, simply because hemp can be combined with other materials and touch so many different areas. The seeds can be eaten, and many grocery stores already carry products from Canada. The plant can be pressed for oil used as a health supplement. And the fiber can be used in items from clothing to building materials to car manufacturing. It can even be processed into compostable kitty litter.
It sounds ridiculous, you know, it's like we say it can make 25,000 different products and it sounds like such a gross exaggeration, but it's really not.
It's not open season for industrial hemp just yet. The crop will still be regulated by the state, and the Commonwealth's Agriculture Department is working on new guidelines now. Rachel McDevitt in Harrisburg.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. You can find those episodes at trumponearth.org. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.